It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Coyotes live all across the continent, and we can find them in every part of Wisconsin. They build burrows into the ground and use tree stumps and other secluded spaces for their dens. And when they venture out in the fall and winter, they can travel more than 100 miles looking for new territory. Coyotes thrive in the wilderness, but they're also in our state's urban areas, and they've moved within Madison's city limits. Steve Gotcher joined a group of scientists in the field studying the animals. Here's what he found in this glimpse into Wisconsin life.
Just after sunrise on a chilly late November morning, I'm among a group of UW-Madison students as part of a study of coyotes in an urban environment. The goal is to understand how coyotes and humans coexist in the city. We're hoping to catch a coyote in one of the locations around Madison's west side, find out about its overall health, and fit the animal with a radio collar to study its movements throughout the town. The sparse snow cover crunches underfoot as our guide,
Sarah Julia Garza. I am a PhD student assisting Dr. David Drake with the Urban Canid Project here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Leads the way down a path at the Lakeshore Nature Preserve.
So we've got a bait pile set out over here. By bait pile, I mean a deer carcass that somebody killed, and it was on the side of the road, basically. And so what we're going to do is we're going to go into this area here. We're going to walk single file so as to minimize our impact on the area, and we'll check the sites, and hopefully we'll be catching something. And let's all go in.
By examining a coyote up close, researchers will be able to study pack territoriality, movement patterns throughout the city, what their food sources are, any diseases they may be carrying, and...
In this environment, I imagine people will be more concerned about the interactions of the urban canids and their own pets.
The trail snakes through the woods and then opens on a small meadow. Patches of crunchy snow dot the area with tufts of dead prairie grass swaying in the gentle breeze. A desiccated deer carcass lays in the center of the clearing with orange flags dotting the area, marking where the traps are situated.
It's a cable restraint trap. It's the same mechanism as a dog's choke collar.
A quick search of the area reveals...
Oh, got some tracks. All right, so here we have here's our bait pile. And it looks like none of the traps have an animal in it, unfortunately, so...
We head back to the cars and make our way to the second site in the UW Arboretum, just west of the visitor center in Curtis Prairie. A sea of tall grass rustles in the light breeze under the gray overcast. As the morning progresses, the temperature slowly drops below freezing.
Anyway, we've got two sites here, and similar setup as before with the cable restraints. One of them, I'm going to ask you guys to kind of stay on the main path and away from it while I go check it out, because we're trying to minimize our impact on it. And the other one is more in a heavily trafficked area, so we can all definitely take a look at the drop site.
A well-used hiking trail parallels the road leading to the Arboretum Visitor Center before it turns, heading deeper into the prairie.
Now, yesterday when we checked these traps, we saw quite a lot of tracks indicating high activity, but nobody had gotten in the traps, so.
Just off the path, set back in the prairie grass, is the site we hope will hold a captured coyote.
So we're trying to catch two animals here in the Arboretum, because the pack territoriality, you can see right here from the side, we got that flag right there.
Yeah.
And you can actually see the bait pile from here. Holy cow, we have an animal. Oh my goodness, okay, I'm texting Drake right now. All right, we're going to back off.
Within 30 minutes, veterinary students arrive on the scene, along with lead researcher
David Drake. I'm an extension wildlife specialist and professor in the Department of Forest Wildlife Ecology, and I'm what's called the principal investigator for this project.
We come in with a pole noose, and we just slip a pole noose around the animal's head to control the head to make sure that it can't swing around and bite us as we hand-inject a double sedative in the back leg. And so that's what we did. And once we get the sedative injected, then we'll back off for about 10 minutes, let the sedative work, and then we'll go back in to see how sedated the animal is. And once the animal's comfortably sedated and we're comfortable that the animal's sedated enough, then we'll go and we'll start processing the animal and work the animal up.
The sedated coyote is brought out from the trap site and placed on a tarp spread out on the trail. The animal is still somewhat awake, so to keep it calm, a towel is placed over its head.
We coordinate with the vet students so that vet students who are interested in perhaps some aspect of wildlife vet medicine, they get an opportunity and some experience handling wild animals. And the vet students are just so much adept at, taking the health samples than we are. So it's good experience for them, and it's tremendously helpful for us, and it's just much more efficient for us.
A small group of vet students surround the young female coyote on their hands and knees, and the examination begins, led by
Emily Gregg, and I'm one of the coordinators for the Urban Canid Project.
So we're checking for fleas with this flea comb. And we're taking vitals, so temperature, respiratory rate, and heart rate. We will be taking a nasal swab and a rectal swab, and then a fecal sample as well.
When all the samples have been taken and the animal is weighed, ours was 31 pounds, it's fitted with a radio collar and color-coded ear tags. The crew works quickly and efficiently, and the entire process takes just over 30 minutes to complete. After an injection is given to reverse the sedative, the group packs up and heads to the parking lot. A couple of observers stay behind and watch as the animal slowly stirs, looks around, cautiously gets up, and takes a few halting steps. Soon the effects of the sedative wear off and the young female is seen trotting down the trail into the prairie.
So now what we'll do is that collar is turned on, and starting at 9 o'clock tonight, that collar will start communicating with the satellite. Mm-hmm. Satellites, and for the rest of that collar's life, for the rest of that animal's life, we'll hopefully get 8 fixes a night on that animal to see where it's going.
The UW Urban Canid Project is in its 6th year of research. To find out more, go to our website at WPR.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
And Wisconsin Life celebrates what makes this place we call home unique. We bring you diverse stories that are funny and that are surprising and thought-provoking. You can hear Wisconsin Life every week across the Ideas Network. Coming up, tens of thousands of Americans are labeled missing. But research shows that missing white women get a disproportionate amount of media coverage. We learn why other segments of the population get overlooked, and we want to hear from you on this. Are you a relative or a friend of someone who went missing, but they didn't get as much media coverage as you had expected or had hoped for? Help us understand what that experience was like at 800-642-1234. Do you think the disparity in coverage between white people and people of color is something that news outlets should be blamed for? Or is it us, news consumers, who are the issue? Why do you think white women tend to get more media attention than other segments of the population? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Whether they went missing a few days ago or a few decades ago, their family and friends haven't stopped looking. They haven't stopped holding on to hope that a loved one will be found. But is their case in the media's eye? Think press conferences, local, perhaps national and international press, following each new development, those chances are very slim, especially for people of color. We're looking at the disparity in media coverage for missing people of color compared to their white counterparts, and your perspectives are welcome. 800-642-1234. Are you a relative or a friend of someone who went missing, but they didn't get much or perhaps any media coverage? Tell us about that. Are media outlets catering to their audiences in focusing on certain cases, or are news consumers driving the focus toward what's called missing white woman syndrome? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234. Zach Summers is a law and science fellow at Northwestern University who studies crime. He published the study Missing White Woman Syndrome, an empirical analysis of race and gender disparities in online news coverage of missing persons. Zach, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, the way the media covered Jamie Kloss's disappearance and the way that consumers in Wisconsin, news consumers and across the nation consumed her story, has been associated with what we call missing white woman syndrome. You've researched whether there was any merit to this. Can you first tell us what is missing white woman syndrome?
Sure. So missing white woman syndrome is the idea that the amount of news coverage that a missing persons case receives is dependent upon the demographic characteristics of the individual that has gone missing. And the specific idea is that young white girls or young white women are disproportionately likely to receive any news coverage at all, and also a lot of news coverage within that segment of the missing persons population that receives any news coverage.
So what did you find out? Is there any merit to this?
There is. So I was surprised at the outset when I first started doing the research and looking into things that there had been a lot of discussion on the topic, but relatively little empirical analysis. And so when I underwent the empirical analysis, I found exactly what we would expect, which is that there's sort of a two-stage level of disparity here, in that young white women and young white girls are more likely to receive any news coverage at all, and then also more likely to receive the high-intensity amount of news coverage that a case like Jamie Kloss has received.
When you looked at the level of coverage that certain missing persons received, you focused on internet news rather than TV or newspapers. What did internet news tell you that TVs or newspapers couldn't?
The main motivation behind looking at internet news was that that is the medium that most people in America these days get their news from. And many of the classic studies on crime and the intersection of crime and news media in the past have focused on newspapers or TV studies. And internet news is a little bit messier. It's a little bit more difficult to deal with from an empirical standpoint. But I thought extending the literature into that area was something that was sorely needed in a way to bring that literature more up to date.
What about social media visibility and shares? Isn't social media supposed to be the great equalizer?
Yeah, I think in some ways it can be. In some ways it provides access to individuals and a microphone to individuals who otherwise wouldn't have a voice. But in some ways, and we need more data on this, but in some ways social media actually might just exacerbate differences, because the people who can weaponize, for lack of a better term, social media to their benefit and reach more eyeballs are people who already have certain characteristics that are going to benefit them in terms of searches for missing persons or investigation outcomes.
So how does missing white woman syndrome distort reality? In other words, what do the numbers look like? Are there actually more white women who go missing than members of other demographic groups?
Disproportionately, there are actually fewer. There are more white individuals who go missing than any other racial group in the United States, but that's more a function of the fact that there are more white people in the United States than any other race group. They actually, though, by proportion, are fewer white individuals who go missing than we would expect. And from a gender perspective, there actually are slightly more boys and men who go missing as compared to girls and women. And in my study, what I found was that, for example, looking at coverage intensity, about half of the news stories across the four websites that I looked at were concentrating on missing white girls and missing white women in particular, which is a significantly disproportionate share when you compare it to the rate at which that group goes missing.
We're talking with Northwestern University Law and Science Fellow Zach Summers about a documented tendency by the news media to cover the missing person cases and abductions of white women, white girls, far more than boys, poor children, children of color. Gathering your thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. Is this about privilege and class? Is this about race? Where do you see the disparities and what cases media focus on and why? The number is 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Zach, how do news consumers factor into this coverage gap between white women and other segments of the population? Are they part of this, driving the news direction here?
Yeah, I think they are. I think that the phenomenon is reflective of some broader trends in our society writ large. But I think that when you drill down into that, it's reflective of both practices on the news production side, but also on the news consumption side. And at the end of the day, many news organizations are for-profit businesses, and they're driven by metrics such as page views and general readership, things like that. And if their metrics are telling them that cases about young white girls or young white women are getting more page clicks, then that's going to drive future behavior in that context.
But all news consumers aren't white, so can we really see that this phenomenon is due to that?
Yeah, I think that it's reflective of some of our broader norms in society. And I think that we see white individuals overrepresented in a variety of different areas, whether it's entertainment or news coverage. And I think it's just a function of the fact that we are very comfortable with representations of white individuals in certain contexts. And as victims of crime, I think that is one category where that is cognitively easy for news consumers to see a white individual who's gone missing and be able to relate to that person.
And in your research, not only did you find that white women were more likely to be subject of news coverage than others, but you also noticed that they were covered more intensely than others. Can you tell us what that intensity looks like and why that is significant?
Sure. So this distinction is putting a name to the differences that we see in terms of the initial threshold decision of whether a case gets covered at all, and then the subsequent decision of, okay, we've covered this case once. Do we want to return to it as a news organization and cover it again, or maybe again about 20 times? And I think the distinction is important because there's fundamentally a difference between a case that receives, say, one or two news stories about it versus one like Jamie Kloss or any of the other number of missing persons cases that have received dozens or hundreds or thousands of news stories about them. And it's a different level of pressure that it provides on police departments. It's a different level of national awareness about a case. And so just looking at that threshold issue of whether a case receives any coverage at all can actually paint somewhat of an incomplete picture.
Media apply pressure to police departments. They're looking for new developments, new answers. Is that pushing a case forward?
Intuitively, it certainly makes sense that it is. We don't have enough of an empirical basis to make any conclusive claims about this yet. It's actually an issue that I'm working on as a follow-up to the initial study. But intuitively, we know that police departments, they have PR departments. They use news media themselves to further investigations. So it makes sense from a logical perspective that they would react dynamically to cases with differing levels of news coverage. And in that sense, a case like Jamie Kloss's that receives so much attention on a national scale, a police department certainly would want to, you would think, solve that case, maybe dedicate more resources to it. But again, the empirics here are relatively limited, and we can't say anything too definitive about it.
When you look at coverage, and there's also the thing of media feeding frenzies, where one newslet covers it, and then another news outlet says, we got to cover this, and then it just spirals from there. Is that part of this?
Yeah, I think that is. And that, again, proves somewhat difficult to measure in terms of the motivations behind newsroom editorial decisions. But I think once it starts getting, a case starts getting a little bit of coverage on a national scale. It kind of balloons beyond the local or regional level. I think there's then starts to be somewhat of a copycat effect, and you start to see other regional sources or sources from across the country or national sources jump in and say, hey, you know, this coverage getting cases, getting some attention out west, maybe we should be covering it as well.
Research published last month in the journal PLOS One looked at racial and gender differences in missing children's recovery. As part of their work, the researchers said that the chances for media coverage of cases are, quote, highly unequally distributed. Certain famous incidents receive national and even international attention, while others entirely ignored. We're looking at why this is with Zach Summers. He's a law and science fellow at Northwestern University who studies crime. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think white women tend to get more media attention than other parts of the population? And what do you think should be done about this? Call in, email ideas, WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about missing persons on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Who grabs media attention and who doesn't? How does race and gender factor into the headlines and news graphics and social media shares? Looking back through the years, in 1996, it was JonBenet Ramsey. In 2002, it was Elizabeth Smart. 2005, Natalie Holloway. 2018, Jamie Kloss. They became household names after their cases made headlines for months, some even years. Why do you think that these cases developed like they did? Do you think the disparity in coverage between white people and people of color is something that news outlets should be blamed for, or are news consumers driving that bias? Perhaps it's both. The number is 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Zach Summers stays with us. He's a law and science fellow at Northwestern University who studies crime. Zach, the study you published starts with you laying out the stories of two different people, Aaron Hubbard, a 17-year-old African-American high school student from Chicago, and Hannah Anderson, a white teenager from California. Can you tell us a bit about them and what you were looking for here?
Sure. So as you mentioned, they were both teenagers who unfortunately went missing in calendar year 2013. And there were a lot of similarities about their cases. Aaron was 17 at the time of his disappearance. Hannah was 16 at the time of hers. They both were abducted and missing for about a week. There were searches and investigations leading into their disappearances. And that, unfortunately, is about where the cases, the similarities across the two cases end. Hannah's case ended on a much happier note. She was recovered safely, and her captor was killed by law enforcement. Aaron was unfortunately found a week later with fatal gunshot wounds. And the reason that I think their cases are noteworthy is that they're emblematic, potentially, of missing white woman syndrome. While we have to be careful about overgeneralizing with any specific individual case, I think there's a pretty striking difference here that may be due simply to the fact that these were different individuals with different demographics. As you said, Aaron was a young black man, Hannah was a young white woman. That might be the reason why there was such a dramatic difference in news coverage across these two cases, because Hannah's case received national news coverage, created a media firestorm. Almost no one heard about Aaron Hubbard's case. It received just one or two short stray news stories in local Chicago papers.
Let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Kristen joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. My question is how the circumstances of these missing people, whoever, women or men, children, whatever the situation, how that is factored into this study.
When you say circumstances, what do you mean?
I mean, the situation with Jamie Kloss, it just, you know, there was a public safety element to it, so it would make sense that it would get more media coverage, whereas if somebody just, you know, say runs away from home or, you know, goes missing for another reason, might not be a public, safety issue.
Yeah, Zach, how does public safety threat factor into this?
I think it's in a given individual case, it's highly relevant. I think with Jamie Kloss in her case, obviously the tragic circumstances of her disappearance and what had happened with her family was likely played a major role in the decision to cover that case. With respect to my study, the rationale kind of method of dealing with this is that on the whole, when you look at all missing persons cases, those differences will tend to even out across races. So there's no reason necessarily for us to think that young white women or young white girls are disappearing at rates, greater rates in suspicious circumstances or being abducted at higher rates. And in fact, we have some data to support the fact that that's not the case. And so when we look at all of the individuals across the U.S. who are going missing and looking at a sample size that large, we can assume that any dramatic differences we're seeing across race or gender disparities are due to things other than necessarily the case circumstances and how the person went missing.
The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, they tell us just 17% of children missing from Wisconsin are considered lost, injured, or otherwise missing. Many are considered family abductions, but the majority of the time they're classified as runaways. First of all, does the term runaway elicit preconceived ideas?
I think it certainly does. And I think when we label a missing child as a runaway, there's less of a sense of urgency to find that child. We don't have quite the same emotional or urgent response as opposed to someone who's been abducted, especially someone who's been abducted by a stranger. And there's also some anecdotal evidence and some limited research into racially disproportionate use of the word runaway, that if we have, say, a young black girl or a young black man, they are more likely to be labeled as runaways as opposed to their white counterparts, which then can lead to a chain of events that leads to all sorts of different outcomes in the investigation.
How do the circumstances of someone's disappearance affect the way we as news consumers internalize the situation? How do these classifications affect the way law enforcement handles it?
Yeah, I think with respect to law enforcement, often law enforcement are playing a major role in these classifications. And again, there's going to be likely a lesser sense of urgency on law enforcement's behalf to solve a case that's been labeled as a runaway, as opposed to someone who's been labeled as abducted or missing under suspicious circumstances. With respect to the newsworthiness and news consumers, we're more captivated by someone who's missing not of their own accord, by someone who's been abducted, as opposed to someone who's just left home or run away. And so in that sense, it ties back into the old maxim, which certainly seems to be true. If it bleeds, it leads. And if it's criminally related, if there's something a little bit dangerous about the situation, it seems to be considered more newsworthy and something that news consumers are more interested in.
Okay, I want to throw at you a few different factors that perhaps may contribute to disparities. Affluent middle-class family with connections, someone standing in a community, how much they're interconnected into the community, how many people know them, and the picture that is put out there about the missing person. How do these things factor in?
I certainly think they're relevant. I think especially in dealing with any issue relating to crime and news coverage and race, race and class often are highly correlated with one another. So I try to control a little bit for this in my analysis, in the statistical analysis that I conduct, and don't find much of an effect of general kind of macro level economic factors of the area in which the person went missing. But I think it's certainly logical that a person with more means and more people with influence who are concerned about their disappearance are going to be able to pull those levers and influence news coverage and maybe get their story out there better than other families or other individuals can.
Talking with Zach Summers, he's a law and science fellow at Northwestern University who studies crime. Still time for you in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Zach, no one knows exactly how many Native American girls and women are missing or murdered, and that's a big gap there, a big issue. But you don't see their stories in the headlines very much. What can your research tell us about how coverage varies among non-white ethnic groups?
It's a difficult question to answer, in large part because they are so infrequently covered. So I did look for distinctions across different non-white racial groups, and in particular with Native Americans, there are just so few of them covered, and they are such a small population group that it's hard to draw any definitive conclusions. It's a question that has received and is starting to receive more news coverage and more attention from academics, which I think is a positive development. It's also a question that has been addressed in an international context, with Aboriginal individuals going missing in Canada, for example, receiving some attention from scholars. But we, at this point, know sadly very little, and can say very little other than to pretty confidently say these cases of Native American missing individuals receive far less attention from police organizations and news organizations, it seems. But again, we need more empirical basis for that claim to say anything more definitive.
Well, we know what the research tells us. What is the solution here? What would you put out there?
There are a couple solutions. I think from the news production side of things, news organizations could be more cognizant of these types of disparities. They could keep internal metrics, for example, of the types of individuals in the cases that they are covering. Maybe more practically, just ensuring that we have a diversity of voices in the newsroom would be very helpful. Having more women and people of color being involved in editorial decisions could result in more proportional coverage of these types of cases. From a news consumer perspective, I think a couple of things that can be done are being cognizant and conscientious of where you get your news from, trying to get your news from an organization that is a little bit more aware of these types of issues. Secondarily, there are some nonprofits that do great work in this area, whether it's the Black and Missing Foundation or the Center for Media Justice. Their support, or supporting them, giving them, learning about them, maybe making a donation, I think is also a great way to potentially help ease the disparities that we see in this sphere.
Where does your research go from here?
As I mentioned, I am interested in working on trying to figure out if these disparities in coverage lead to differential outcomes in police investigations. And that's sort of the next step, because I think that would provide some tangible evidence of a concrete effect of these disparities in news coverage in a way that goes beyond the kind of abstract violation of the notion of justice that we have to this point, and would give us a little bit something more specific that we could say, hey, here's a consequence of this disparity and why it's even more important than we already thought it was.
Zach, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Zach Summers is a law and science fellow at Northwestern University who studies crime. He published the study Missing White Woman Syndrome, an empirical analysis of race and gender disparities in online news coverage of missing persons. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Reducing the number of people immigrating to the U.S. has been a top priority for the Trump administration. One of the earliest moves was to limit the number of refugees who came to the country, and that's led to a sharp decline nationwide in the number of refugees who've resettled in the U.S. in recent years and in the number resettling here in Wisconsin. Will Cushman is an associate editor at WisConText. He recently took a closer look at these numbers in a new piece you can find online at wiscontext.org. Here's the Ideas Network host, Darrell Connor.
Now, what do we know about how many refugees resettled in Wisconsin last year?
So last year, there were 472 refugees resettled in Wisconsin. That's about a little under 20% less than 2017, but really the big difference is from 2016. It's a over 75% decrease from the 2016 resettlements.
Do we have an idea, or at least some idea, as to why we're seeing less refugees now than in years past?
Sure. Yeah. So if you look at the charts that we have in WisContext, you can see kind of a general trend line going up during the first decade and a half of the 21st century. But yeah, you're right. Over the last couple of years, it's gone down quite a bit, and that is, we think, pretty much due to federal policy. For 2018, the Trump administration set the cap of refugees that would be accepted into the United States at 45,000, which was the lowest such cap basically since the refugee resettlement program began in 1980. And actually, the actual numbers of refugees resettled in the United States last year was much lower at almost 23,000. We also think there were fewer refugees because some previous refugees have been coming from countries that are affected by the travel ban, Somalia, Syria, a few other countries.
Now, you were referring to the charts that's in your piece about refugees and the drop-off. It also showed in your piece that there was a problem for some of the employers in the Milwaukee area. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Yeah. So I haven't spoken to any of these employers myself, but I did hear from one source, Mary Flynn. She is the refugee resettlement coordinator in the Milwaukee area for Lutheran Social Services. And she told me that she has been hearing from a number of employers in the Milwaukee area who historically have depended on refugees for jobs that, I guess, otherwise a lot of local job seekers would not want. I guess they're, for the most part, lower-paying jobs. Several employers told Ms. Flynn there in the Milwaukee area that they are kind of struggling looking for workers to replace this what otherwise had been quite a large number of refugees coming to the Milwaukee area.
Now, it looks like there is a struggle there in the part of employers, at least in Milwaukee, in the state. But how do we compare to the rest of the country? Are you seeing that trend play out in other places around the country?
Sure. Yeah. So refugee numbers are down across the nation. You're correct. And really, it does vary wildly from state to state how many refugees they received last year and historically over the last couple of decades. Wisconsin has consistently ranked about middle of the pack. In 2018, Wisconsin placed 20th, I think, in number of refugees that were resettled. There's several states that resettle a lot of refugees. Those include Texas, Washington State, Ohio, California. Often states with already larger populations. And then there's also, on the flip side, some states that received no refugees last year. So that would be Hawaii, Wyoming. And yeah, there's a very wide range.
Is there a difference besides the population between states like Texas and California that are receiving a lot of refugees versus Wisconsin who have experienced a drop off? Is it a matter of the type of employers that are in those states? What is driving that?
So what's driving the actual location of the refugee resettlements is it's pretty complex, but I think boiled down, some of the biggest factors are kind of historical ties to already established refugee communities. So a lot of refugees are reuniting with relatives, family members, friends who they know from their nation of origin. So they're going to those same communities. Also, a lot of the resettlement agencies that work on resettling refugees, they'll place refugees kind of in the same areas that they're familiar with working in already.
Will Cushman is an associate editor at WisContext, and we're talking about the decline in the number of refugees that are settling in the state of Wisconsin. When you look at the charts that you've included in your piece, there was a big spike in the number of refugees in 2004. What was behind that?
Right, yeah. So I mentioned earlier that there is a pretty gradual trend line moving up from about 2002 to 2016 in the number of refugees, but that doesn't include this, you're right, a big spike in 2004 and to a lesser extent in 2005. That is related to, those are primarily Hmong refugees who had left Laos and were in the last Thai refugee camp that closed right around that time. And so there is a large number of Hmong refugees who were in that last refugee camp in Thailand who came to Wisconsin because they have historical ties to several Wisconsin communities.
Now, you talked about folks from Laos that were coming in 2004 and 2005. What do we know about the refugees that are coming here now in 2019?
Sure. Yeah, so it's changed quite a bit. Basically, starting in about 2006 or 2007, there are a large number, large and growing number of refugees coming from Burma, also known as Myanmar. And these are refugees who belong to a couple different groups. One is the Karen people. Another one, which our listeners maybe have heard quite a bit of about in the last year or so, are the Rohingya. They're a predominantly Muslim minority from Burma. That have been essentially the target of ethnic cleansing, genocide by the ruling military regime.
Now, how does the resettlement process work for refugees?
It's quite a long, complicated process. It can take anywhere from like a year and a half to over 2 years for once a refugee has begun the process to be resettled. It starts with usually a designation from the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, who then works with, in the case of the United States, with the U.S. State Department, who coordinates with several other federal agencies, all sorts of screenings from health screenings to security screenings. There's a lot that goes into it, the vetting process is pretty extensive, but yeah, it can take quite a long time. And actually, I think only about 1% of the refugees who kind of apply with the UN actually make it through the process to resettlement in any given year.
And do we know where refugees are being resettled here in Wisconsin?
Yeah. So Metro Milwaukee is definitely the largest destination for refugees in the state. Makes sense. It's the largest population center in the state. But otherwise, the Fox Cities are also a popular destination. Appleton and Oshkosh, and I think that is partly driven by the resettlement agencies that work in the Fox Cities. They're already growing refugee populations there. Also Dane County and historically the Wausau area and some other larger counties as well. But they're resettled kind of in communities all throughout the state. Barron, Wisconsin is a pretty small town up in northwestern Wisconsin. They have a sizable Somali refugee population. It depends.
And finally, what did you hear from the people who work on resettling refugees about what they think about the drop in numbers?
Sure. I would say they still view obviously their work is very important needed. And I think while they, from what I heard in my interviews with them, they're disappointed with the decreasing numbers of refugees coming to Wisconsin and to the United States. They have, to varying extents, planned for it. But yeah, I think they are looking to continue their services in whatever capacity they can. One refugee resettlement organization in Wisconsin, Catholic Charities of Milwaukee, did end their resettlement program in July. But the other half a dozen or so are still gone.
Will, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Darrell.
Will Cushman works on WisConText. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.